Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Chuck Smith, who directed a production of Knock Me a Kiss for the West Coast Black Theater Troupe in Sarasota, Florida. Chuck's story is really unique. Chuck thought he was always going to be a Marine. Surprise to him and everyone else that he dedicated his life to the theater. Listen to how that happened. Stay tuned. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about self-discovery. In a way, it's about courage. The courage to ask yourself the question, am I all of who I really am? Am I living the life that my innate nature, my innate talent, my given essence would have made possible? Or was there a lesson that I learned from my family of origin, from a teacher in school, from the culture I was raised in, from my siblings or my peers, from my religion, from something I read or heard, from some traumatic event that occurred in my life that told me not to be who I really am? Was there something that happened to me early on in my life that discouraged me from pursuing the things that turned me on? Maybe even something I knew that turned me on at the very beginning of my life. If you've been listening to my interviews, then you know that so many of the people that I interview, people who make their living or their life with an art, knew at two what they were meant to do, what they were drawn to, what they had passion for, what they yearned to be part of. I think it was last week, I played the interview with Joyce Valentine, who sat down and played at two what her mother had been teaching a 7-year-old student. This was not negotiable. Joyce knew that the piano was the place for her, virtually from the time she could stand, apparently. And this is not that uncommon. I hear this story a lot from musicians, ironically. People who started playing at 2 or 3 or 4. But I also hear this from fine artists. People who picked up a pencil or a crayon or something and were doing amazing things with it and could not actually be parted from it. I think it was Gail Fulton Ross who tells the story of how her mother had to put her crayons and drawing stuff outside, otherwise she couldn't get Gail to go out. And so it's just not uncommon for people to discover so young, so early in life, what they are drawn to, what they have a passion for, what speaks to them. I think it was Kate Alexander, a brilliant actor, who told me that she remembers sitting on a stage. She had gone to see a performance, and she was on the stage with her feet hanging over the stage, thinking, this is where I want to be. I think she was 7. She didn't really know what acting was, but she knew that she wanted to be there. So, this is not uncommon, and yet, unfortunately, few of us are given the encouragement to follow our natural inclinations. And this doesn't just apply to talents, abilities, skills that we might have been drawn to or attracted to or that spoke to us. This is also true, perhaps even more true, to ways of being. Did you laugh out loud at the kitchen table? Did you laugh so hard at the kitchen table that food spilled out of your mouth or your nose or something? And then were you told in no uncertain terms that that kind of laughing is a bad, bad thing? Leave the table or just don't do it or something? And so did you decide that a certain kind of explosive joy was not for you? That you were not to feel that, express that? Did you get angry or hurt or cry or frightened? And did you hear from a religious person or a teacher that that was not good behavior? You were not to get angry. Anger was the devil's something, or was unattractive, or didn't get you anywhere, or maybe you were even punished for it. Go to your room. Who do you think you are? Don't do that. And of course, this, you know, applies across the board to every kind of behavior, every kind of impulse. Did you want to read all the time? And did someone tell you that that was not okay? I interviewed a writer once who told me that he would write these little stories when he was quite young, 6, 7, 8, and hide them around the house. And that his mother found one of them, and in it he had said some things about a neighbor that weren't true, it was fiction, but they weren't very nice. And his mother was horrified and forbid him to write again. In this particular case, it didn't do any good. This was Stuart Kaminsky, who prolific doesn't begin to describe Stuart's output. And unfortunately, we could have had so much, much, much more from Stuart, but he died much too young. But he did leave us a huge, huge legacy. And if you're not familiar with Stuart Kaminsky's work, especially if you like mystery fiction, run right out to your local library and read Stuart Kaminsky. We hear these things, we get these experiences, things happen to us in our childhood which discourage us from sometimes just from completely expressing, exploring our passion. But for many, it's not just an interruption. It's a flat-out denial. You will not be like that. You will not do that. That is not okay. I won't love that. So I won't love you if you are like that. And that's, of course, how we interpret it. Or that's dangerous, or it's ugly, or it's evil. And so too many of us are forced, in order to survive our childhoods, in order to be okay in our childhoods, to hide, pretend, deny aspects of ourselves. I'm a psychotherapist, in case you couldn't tell and didn't know because you're listening for the first time. So I am a psychotherapist, and of course this is my bias. My bias is that we have the right to be what we would have been if we had not been discouraged. And that it is never too late to ask the question, was there something I could have been, might have been, should have been? And what was it? And how did I lose it? And it is my belief that we never lose it. That all those things that we are go underground. I call it undercover. We bury them deep inside ourselves, but we don't lose them. We can't amputate parts of ourselves. So they're always there, and they're always waiting. But because they were hidden, as a result of our deciding that they were ugly or dangerous or would cost us something we weren't willing to lose, it's hard to recover them, because the recovery, the attempt to recover, also brings back the taboo, the early learning, the discouragement, the pain, if there's pain attached to it, and usually there is. I'm treating a number of people whose the experiences of their first couple of years were so unpleasant that their ability to feel safe is undercover. Their ability to not be vigilant every minute of the day is undercover. So it is the intention of this show, as well as the intention of all the work I do, to make this point, to say, you may be living a cover story. That's what I call it. That's the version of yourself that was acceptable. It's the truth, but it's not the whole truth. It is likely that you have buried some aspect of yourself, and that your life is poorer because of that. It's obvious if you can't feel safe, if you have to be worried, watching, and vigilant every minute of the day, how much richer your life would be if you didn't have to do that. But it's also true that if you were a natural artist, that sitting with a blank sheet of paper and a pencil or a crayon or a pen, the hours melted away and you created something that you could see evolving and that brought you the most delicious joy, and that somehow you lost the permission to do that, you can see how much richer your life would be if you could get that back. So this is the intention of the Lynn Show, to encourage you to ask the question, is there something? And if there is, the chances are you actually even know it. And then to ask the question, am I willing to try to recover it? Because it really does take courage. As I said, when you go after the recovery process, you get back whatever it was that stopped you. So it can be difficult. This is, of course, what psychotherapy is all about. This is, well, one of the things that psychotherapy is meant to do, is help us to be all that we are. So you might want to think about that.
And to help us all see, feel, discover what it is to be all that we really are, I play interviews in my show with people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because in this culture, we make it so difficult for people to make part of their life, never mind a living, with an art, that when you listen to people who have actually done it, who are doing it, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. It's glaringly apparent. And the interview I'm airing today is an interview I did with Chuck Smith, who is a director, a theater director, who is in Sarasota, having directed Knock Me a Kiss for the West Coast Black Theater Troupe. And Chuck is something of an anomaly. He is definitely a man who becomes who he is, who is who he is in everything that he does. But what's so extraordinary about Chuck is that having demonstrated an aspect of himself, having been true to an aspect of himself, in this case, becoming a Marine, being, as he thinks of himself, a military man, when he discovers another aspect of himself, serendipitously, unexpectedly, without having looked for it, he jumps on that, inhabits that, allows himself to be that. He doesn't spend a lot of time asking himself, is this what I should be doing? Is this okay? Would other people do this? He listens to himself, and he follows his own lead. And that's what I am hoping you will hear when you listen to Chuck Smith tell you the story of his journey and how he wound up where he is. So here, from himself, Chuck Smith. Okay, I'm here with Charles Smith.
Chuck Smith.
You know, I saw that, and I was going to ask what
there's
you would
two,
have preferred.
There's two people. Charles Smith is the writer, playwright, good friend of mine.
Right.
And I'm Chuck Smith, the director. We're both from Chicago, but we're two different people.
So we're going to start again.
Okay.
So I'm here with Chuck Smith,
right,
the director.
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
That's who
you're
with.
Yeah. Yes. And we're here in a tiny office in West Coast Black Theater Troupe in Sarasota, Florida, because Chuck is here to direct Knock Me a Kiss.
That is correct. By Charles Smith.
Oh.
See? Yeah.
Yes.
That's why people get us mixed up. It's been happening for over 20 years.
I'm sure.
So we're used to it. We're used to it.
Well, okay. Yeah. All right. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Uh-huh.
And you certainly qualify.
Yeah, I do now.
Well, and the art is directing or theater?
Theater.
Or
theater.
Theater. Yeah.
Primarily directing, but I'm a resident director at the Goodman Theater.
Uh-huh.
But I'm an independent producer, theater artist, which brings me here.
Yeah. Okay, so I only ask one question.
Uh-huh.
And that is, can you remember the very first moment in your life when stories, acting, directing, theater, any of that captured you, called you?
Yeah, I can remember that.
When?
Sure. It was my very first play. I was fresh out of the Marine Corps. Thinking.
Oh, wait. So you didn't, there was none of this beforehand?
No. I came into this at the age of 25.
Wow.
Yeah. And like I say, I was fresh out of the Marine Corps, getting ready to go back into the Marine Corps because I was a little, I got out just to sort of check out civilian life, and it wasn't what I thought it might be.
Well, what made you go into the Marine Corps in the first place?
That's the only thing I've ever wanted to do in my life as a kid, was join the Marine Corps. So, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, do you remember what it was about The Marine Corps?
Yeah, sure, exactly. Yeah, my uncle mm-hmm. served in World War II,
mm-hmm.
and I'm an old guy. I'm a senior citizen, so I mean, I go back. And when he served as a merchant marine.
Yeah.
And his ship was lost at sea for like about, he was missing in action in the Atlantic for like about 2 weeks, and my family disintegrated. As a toddler, I'm watching my family just disintegrate because my uncle is missing. My uncle, the Marine, is missing.
Yeah.
And so I says, he's an important man. I want to be just like my uncle.
You want to matter.
I'm going to be a Marine. Yeah. And that was the beginning of it. Now, by the time I realized that he was a merchant Marine, right. I was already hooked on the Marines.
Yeah, I got it. So, I got it.
And that's it. From that point on, I knew exactly what I was going to do with my life, and that's exactly what I did.
Yeah.
I got out of high school. I was 17. My mother wouldn't sign for me, so she talked me into going to college for a year. And fine, but as soon as that year was up, I joined the Marine Corps, and I was in the Marines for, I served the Marines for 2 enlistments, and I got, basically, I got homesick
mm-hmm.
for a minute, and I came home, and I was getting ready to go back, and then, to make a long story short, I walked into a theater, I never walked out.
What did you see?
Well, basically, when I say I walked into a theater, I walked into the theater environment.
Where were you physically?
In Chicago.
Uh-huh.
I'm born and raised in Chicago. Everything I, you know, I'm still there. Mm-hmm. And I went. The two guys I knew who were in a community theater group. They were doing a play called Mac Adam and Eve. And they needed one of the actors had dropped out during tech, and they needed me to come in
as an actor.
As an actor, they needed an actor real quick. They needed somebody to stand. So I agreed to do it. I went in and learned the lines, and I was doing the role. And first, you know, it was a comedy, and I was saying these words, and people were laughing, and I was very upset because I didn't want people laughing at me. You know,
God.
I didn't know. I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
And They tried to explain, at an admission, I said, look, I'll do this, I'll do it, but this is the last time because I can't stand having people laughing at me, you know. And so they tried to explain, no, they're not laughing at you, Chuck, they're laughing at your character and all that. They're telling me all the right things that I don't understand.
And actually, because you're doing a good job.
I'm doing a good job, yeah.
Right, right.
So, curtain call.
Right.
You know, the first wave goes in, you know, people laugh, la la la, clap, clap, clap. Second wave, clap, clap, clap. And then I walks in, and they, yay! That was the moment.
Oh, so you're a natural actor.
Yes, natural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I say I'm a natural theater guy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah. Acting is very. I did act for quite some time. I'm a professional actor. I hold an equity card. But acting is not my passion.
Okay, hold on. You're getting too far. So this grabs you, and you say, well, maybe not the Marines. And then what do you do? I mean,
What I did was I stayed with those guys, with that community theater. And from there, I had the GI Bill available to me, so I went back to college and studied theater in college in Chicago.
You got a degree in theater?
Yeah,
or in
business and theater. You know.
Oh, smart guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I see. So, okay, so you get a BA, you get a,
uh-huh,
right?
BA.
And
yeah.
Then you come out and you're like 25 now or something?
Well, no, this is, by the time I got my degree,
because
mm-hmm. I had to work, you know, it was...
So you got a day gig, right? It took me a long time.
Yeah, a day gig. I've been a lot of things. A mailman, a computer programmer, and data analyst, a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But theater was always part of it, you know. And so, and I had a family. And in 1988, my daughter got to the point where she didn't need my financial assistance anymore. So that's when I quit my 9-to-5 and started doing theater full time.
Oh, my goodness.
At the age of 50.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so you would just being a responsible grown-up until then and taking care of your responsibilities and still doing theater on the side, sort of.
Yes.
Okay, so at some point you decided not to... That acting wasn't your you know, that it was directing.
One of the things that I discovered, not early on, but that as a Marine, I was a non-commissioned officer when I was in the Marine Corps, and I was telling people what to do. Actors don't tell people what to do. Actors do what people tell them.
That's right.
I like to tell people what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a director.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly
as simple as that.
So you figured it out fairly soon.
Oh, yeah. It didn't take me long to figure that out.
Okay.
You know.
So did you study directing, or was that part of it?
I studied theater. Acting, directing, I studied everything.
So in this 25-year period, while you're... getting, or 20-year period while you're raising your daughter and, right, and you're working day gigs, you're directing community theater, or?
No, professional. I mean, it evolved to professional theater, Chicago's a smorgasbord.
Yeah, and there's still a lot of theater in Chicago.
Yeah, and a lot of theater. There's a lot of theater in Chicago.
Right.
So, I mean, I was dabbling in a little bit of everything with everybody. Started my own. With three other guys, we started the first African-American equity company to start off as an equity company. We didn't start off as a community theater, we started in a company that was an equity company.
Wow.
You know, in the mid-80s. And again, that was around the time when I started doing this full-time.
So you started to do it full-time, and you've been able to survive.
Yeah, I've never. When I had a really good job at the state of Illinois. Working in computer programming, data analyst. I was, and I was good at that. But it wasn't a passion.
No.
And so as soon as I realized that my daughter didn't need me anymore, then I said it's time to go. So I left. Everybody thought I was crazy.
Really?
I was nuts, yeah.
Who thought you were crazy?
My whole family. Now, you're going to leave a good job with the state? In another 10 years, you can retire. And you're going to say, another 10 years, I could be dead.
That was
my thinking.
Yeah,
I think that has a lot to do with the Marine Corps. You take the moment, You take it. It's time to, you see it, you go for it.
I think it has something to do with the person. Because not everybody in the Marine Corps is giving orders either.
That's true.
And it is a certain kind of person that they put in that place,
yes,
right?
I mean, everybody does it just automatically get there. You're absolutely right.
I agree.
But
so where do you think that comes from in you?
I think that comes from again, I always go back to the Marine Corps, it's because it is, theater is a very disciplined profession.
Right.
And military is a disciplined organization. It's all, I just thought at the time, not thought at the time, I knew at the time, I said, look, you may never get this opportunity again. You stay here, you're going to get hung up in this 9-to-5 thing, and it's really not what you want to do. And so, and the fact that I left the Marine Corps, I can leave this. If I can leave the Marine Corps, I can definitely leave this.
Well, but there's a really, that's a quality, the ability, first of all, to know what you want.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Second of all, to take that risk, to take that leap.
Yeah.
To leave. The Marine Corps is a very safe place.
Extremely safe. Technically it's safe.
Right. And your job, you're with the Illinois, that was a safe place.
It was a safe place, yeah.
But you didn't need to stay in a safe place.
No.
Everybody doesn't have that.
Yeah, I guess not. I would imagine so, yeah.
Well, so. Everybody was saying to you, don't do it, crazy, right?
Yeah,
so you know that the conventional wisdom is you hold on to the safe place.
Yeah.
You don't leap into the nothing.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I did.
Yeah, I left twice.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, I don't, where it comes from, I don't know. It's probably something I got from one of my parents.
I think probably.
Yeah.
Can you think of, I mean, is it a quality that you think of as...
I've never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
You know, I've always, but you're absolutely right. It's jumping off from a safe place.
Yeah.
You know, but it was never a doubt in my mind.
I see it. I mean, you are a person who can take those. I mean, jumping from a really solid, safe job to theater, It's a risk.
Okay,
so but it worked out for you.
It worked out fine. I've never looked back. Not once have I said, you know, I should have stayed there and did that. That if I had stayed there, I could be blah 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 blah. You know.
No.
No. Every now and then years ago, and I'm talking years ago, I would say, if I had stayed in Marine Corps, I would be out now getting this check every month.
Yeah.
I go, but now I'm a senior citizen, so I get a check every month anyway. So, you know.
Yes. Right. Okay. So, do you want to say anything about the kind of work you've done since you started this?
Well, primarily, I'm an African-American theater artist, and I do African-American theater. You know, not that I only do African-American theater, but I sort of focus on African American theater because I think African American theater needs to be focused on.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I believe.
And there's more and more of it.
Yeah. Yes.
Has it grown?
Yes, it has grown. And the appreciation for it is growing, but not as fast as I would like it.
No.
Yeah. You know, but that's what I do. You know, I direct it, I produce it, I do whatever I can to make it happen whenever. Just like coming here,
right,
is, you know, helping to make it happen.
Yeah.
And it's a play that I like. It's a play by my good friend Charles Smith,
mm-hmm.
who years ago, when Charles Smith was fresh out of college, he started working at a company called the Victory Gardens Theater in Chicago, where I had directed many successful plays. And he was answering the phone, and he says, this is Victory Gardens Theater, Charles Smith speaking. And it was, oh, yeah. Man, I saw that play you directed. So he says, no, I'm not. You're talking about Chuck Smith. I'm Charles Smith. I'm a playwright. Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. And this went on for months. And he got sick of it. And so one night at a social gathering, he grabbed me by the arm and pulled me to the side. He says, you know what? I'm sick and tired of people mistaking me for you. He says, I guarantee you, one day someone is going to mistake you for me. And I fell in love with the guy. How can you not like a guy like that? With that kind of a spirit, you know. And so we've been friends ever since. And lo and behold, maybe about 4 years later, someone calls me up and say, hey, Mr. Smith, I'm interested in that play that you wrote. I says, no, well, you know, I think you got the wrong guy. You're looking for Charles Smith. I'm Chuck Smith, the director. He says, but I can definitely get you in touch with Charles. He says, I'd appreciate it. I said, well, just hold on for like, I'll call him and make sure it's okay for me to give him your number and everything. So right away, I called Charles. I said, Charles, guess what happened, man? Somebody called me looking for you. And over the phone, I heard, yes! And now it happens all the time.
Yeah.
Now it happens all the time because he's a very successful writer.
It's great.
He's in charge of playwriting at Ohio University. He's the chairman there, and he's been there for 15 years, and he's got a wonderful program going. And
it's great. That's a great story.
Yeah.
Okay, so the other question I ask is, having given as much of your life to theater as you have, what would you say about what that's like?
It's, for me, knowing where I started out, you know, knowing that I wanted to be a Marine and ended up in theater like this, it obviously was destined to happen, you know. But I can't, as much as I do, I still think about the Marine Corps, but I don't think I could do anything else as well and with the passion that I have for this, you know. And I consider myself very fortunate to be able to do what I do and love it so much, mm-hmm. you know, and do it at different in different parts of the country, you know, especially getting out of Chicago in the wintertime.
Yeah, all right. I hear that.
You know, there's some perks to this, yeah. you know. But yeah, but it's just, to me, it's I can't see doing anything else.
Yeah. You know? It's so interesting. You have had two really serious passions in your life.
Yes, yes. Serious passions.
Right.
Yeah.
And you... What's interesting about the theater thing, you said it, actually. You said, you know, it seemed like it was destined to happen. That accident of some actor falling out on Tech Week and them yeah. asking you to stand in. I mean, that's...
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they couldn't find another actor who yeah. actually was an actor? I mean...
Well, it's community theater.
Ah, yeah, right.
It's community theater.
Yeah.
It's
but
community.
Still...
Yeah, I was there. I was there, and these guys and I, we were drinking buddies in a lounge, you mm-hmm. know, and they were always talking about... when they asked me, I was highly upset.
Why?
I'm a Marine. I'm getting ready to go back in the Marine Corps. These guys asked me to do some artsy stuff
yeah,
like
yeah.
theater.
Yeah.
Don't they know who I am?
It's great. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. They knew who you were. You didn't know who you were.
Evidently.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, but they had to calm me down. In essence, and you know, they you know they used the beautiful carrot. Says, we're in this lounge drinking it. Why do you come to this lounge? I says, to meet girls. He says, let me tell you something.
I hear this coming.
You know that's the, we all know this story. He says, now I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the girls you meet in the lounge, but let me tell you, you can meet a nice, better quality of girls in the theater.
Oh, it's amazing.
And that made sense to me.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Yes, it did. And did you?
Yes, I did. I've been married to two actresses.
You have found So they were right.
They were right.
They were right.
They were right.
It's the thing of being captured by it. That, you know, knowing it when you feel it. You know, you said
yeah.
you came out on the stage. They applauded like
yeah.
crazy, and you said, "This is for me."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you left the Marine Corps.
I left it. Yeah. And it was at a time. That's one of the things that haunts me about leaving the Marine Corps, because some of the guys, I was in a unit in Japan, and I was a lifer. I knew I was going to be there for the rest of, you know,
yeah.
for the whole 20 years. And I was talking to other guys, you know, especially guys from the inner city, black guys from the inner city. I said, look, man, there's nothing back there. Stay here and you can grow, you know, you can develop, you know, and And a lot of them did.
Yeah.
They re-enlisted. I was getting ready to re-enlist when I got homesick. And I said, you know, something, that's a whole nother story. But anyway, I came home and I stayed home. Some of these guys that I talked into staying, they ended up in Vietnam. And one or two of them didn't make it.
Yeah.
So that's on my, that bothers me
yeah.
on a daily basis. That I, you know. And they wrote to me. They said, you know, just in the days of letter writing. So what is it? Why did you were the life. You were the one who was telling everybody to stay in.
Yeah.
And you got out. What did you know that you didn't tell us?
Yeah.
I said, there's no convincing these guys that I didn't know.
No.
You know, there's no way I could convince them. Mm-hmm. And I was like I say, it's one of those things that bothers me.
It's not
a rosy.
No,
you know.
Even though yeah. I know you know
yeah.
that everybody makes a choice for themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But, and of course, you certainly know that when you said what you said,
yeah,
you meant it.
I meant it. I was honest. I was
right.
honest. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But that still doesn't.
And no.
The fact that they.
But
they
life had other
in,
plans for you.
Yeah. They got stuck in Da Nang, and I was on stage.
being applauded.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, no, I think that's a burden. I understand
it.
I understand it. Yeah. So you're paying back by creating all this wonderful art.
Well, I think that has something. I got to make it work.
Yes.
Maybe that's the answer to the question. You know, because of that, I'm driven more to making it work and work well.
Well, and making life better for the people that you can.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, building the African American theater experience makes life better for everybody who participates in
That's true.
Right?
Yes, true. Yeah.
And you do seem to be someone who, to use a military phrase, is virtually always on a mission.
That's true. Sometimes I have too many missions. But, you know, yes. Yeah.
Do you want to say what that means?
Well, no, right now, back in Chicago, I'm working on a huge festival about the works of August Wilson. You know, I'm going to direct, when I leave here, I'm going back to Chicago, back to the Goodman Theater, and start rehearsals for Two Trains Running.
Uh-huh.
And during the run of that show, we're going to do in Chicago, a huge August Wilson celebration. We're going to celebrate all of his works.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be done all over, readings of these of his other 9 plays in the cycle, all over the city of Chicago, along with his one-man show, How I Learned What I Learned, and also 5 or 6 seminars on August Wilson and how he affected different locations. He was in St. Paul, Minnesota for a while, you know. We're going to talk about him in Chicago. We're going to talk about him in New York. We're going to talk about him at Yale. And we're going to talk about the women of his plays. We're going to have a panel discussion of the women of August Wilson. So it's going to be a great festival that I'm putting together.
Yeah.
So
when is this going to be?
This will be in March and April of next year.
Of 2015. Oh, my God. Well, that's very close.
It's very close. So, you know, and I've got everything. I got just about everything in place now. But the last element of I'm putting together a summit. I'm going to bring together African American theater directors and meet with historic black colleges and talk about theater and keeping the name of August Wilson alive and also keeping black theater how we can make black theater a much more powerful force in this.
I'm not going to get this exactly right. Mark Southers, do you know him?
Yeah, Mark Southers.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, well, he's in St. Pete.
Yeah.
Directing Radio Golf.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to hook up.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm glad you reminded me. You know, he said he was going to be around.
Yeah, he is. And they do one of the cycle every year.
Yeah.
So they're at Radio Golf now. And he told me, it's funny, because I was thinking about him when you were talking. He told me this. I interviewed him. He directed a play here.
Uh-huh.
And he told me this wonderful story about, which you probably know, and I'll take all of this out. I edit this, so... Right.
Yeah, yeah.
That he was working as a photographer for a newspaper, and he was videotaping a play. Oh, God, see, I blocked the play. Shoot, I've forgotten the play.
Uh-huh.
But he's sitting in the back, and the machine is on, and he's got no interest in theater, and he's got no interest in anything, right? And he's on the phone, actually. He's talking, right? And then the tape is running. And suddenly, he hears a speech. He stops everything and listens to the speech. And the speech moves him. And it's the beginning of his career.
Yeah,
as He's just captured by it. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I have this powerful belief that there is a place for us, that there is a right thing for us to be doing, and that those of us who are lucky enough to find it very young, or to find ourselves in the place where it catches us, you know, the way you did.
Yes,
you
know,
that,
we're very fortunate.
That's exactly right.
And I know that.
Yeah.
I realize that.
Well.
Yeah.
Okay, is there anything I didn't ask you that I should have asked you?
Oh!
Oh, I know!
Okay.
We should talk about Knock Me a Kiss. Talk about that play.
Well, I've been directing Knock Me a Kiss. I directed the world premiere at the Victory Gardens Theater in the year 2000.
Did you direct one? I have a friend who was in it in New York. Marie Thomas.
You know Marie Thomas?
Oh, God.
Isn't she great?
I know Marie.
Oh, my God.
For 40 years.
Yes, I directed that production. I directed it in New York. And that production won so many awards.
Yes, and I couldn't believe she didn't tell me I'd have been there.
She won, and she's done it. She's done it there. She's done it in New York, and we did it at the National Black Theater.
Yes, she told me.
Twice.
So next time, somebody tell me, and
sure.
I'll show up.
And she was wonderful in this role.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, she's wonderful. I did it first in 2000, and then nobody picked it up. It's a wonderful play.
Yeah, she told me. She said, it's coming there. You have to see it.
Yeah.
Right.
And then I finally stopped waiting on people to do it and made arrangements to help produce it in New York.
Ah.
And so it did, got great reviews, but still nobody from our Broadway wanted to do it. But we did get to a National Black Theater Festival, so we did, and we did it twice at the National Black Theater Festival. And we had a very short run at Crossroads Theater Company in Jersey, but we got caught up at the same time as Hurricane Sandy. I mean, the exact same time we were there, and Sandy killed it. You know, because New Jersey was wrecked, bombed by Sandy.
Yeah.
So that just killed the run.
So, but talk about the play, because
the play,
theoretically people will hear it, we want them to come.
Yeah, the play is about a love affair of W.E.B. Du Bois's daughter, who was really in love with a band leader named Jimmy Lunsford. This is a true story.
Yeah.
With Jimmy Lunsford. But W.E.B. Du Bois didn't want her daughter hanging around with a band leader, so she hooked him up with County Cullen, the poet.
Yeah.
And they got along, and they married, and then right away, they were divorced. Mm-hmm. I ain't gonna tell you no more.
Oh, good. It's a cliffhanger.
I'll tell you no more.
All right.
You know,
okay.
It's a love story.
All right.
It's a wonderful love story.
Do you remember when it's opening?
It officially opens on the 9th of January.
Good. Okay.
Yeah.
And there are previews before.
I would imagine so. I haven't, you know.
Yeah, there are.
It's the first
there
time I've worked
are.
Here at this company. So
well.
I'm sure there'll be previews. I'm sure. Yeah.
So how did this happen that you're here?
They call me.
Is it because of this play? Do you
know? It's the play. I think, I'm pretty sure Nate saw it at the festival and wanted to get it here some kind of a way.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to bring the whole company, but that couldn't happen.
That's so sad.
Yeah, then she would have been here.
That's right.
Yeah.
She could have stayed with me.
But I made sure that he knew that if the company couldn't come, I'm totally willing to come.
Yeah, right. Know?
And then he called and he says, can you come? I says, now where are you guys? He says, we're in Sarasota. I says, now when do you want me to come? He says, December. I said, yes.
That's great. That is really great. Well, okay, so come on out and see Knock Me a Kiss. And
please do.
Yes,
please do.
And hopefully we'll get you back to do something else.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
So I hope that you heard what I heard in this interview. Chuck the Boy discovers that when one is a Marine, people care about you. It matters to them what happens to you. And that becomes a driving force in his life. He will be someone who matters, for whom people care. So at the very first opportunity, he jumps on that and becomes a Marine. He does two tours as a Marine. He is a Marine. He is a military man. That's his identity. That is who he believes himself to be. Then life throws him a curve. He decides to take a little break. He quickly decides that civilian life, really not for him. And he's going to re-up. He's going to do another tour because he's a military man. And then some friends need an actor. Well, he's not an actor. He's actually insulted to be considered an actor. Don't they know who he is? He's a military man, for God's sake. But they appeal to him in the way that people have always been appealing to young men. There are interesting and attractive women there. And so he agrees to help his friends. And then, surprise to him, he is captured by the experience of applause, of the validation of what he's done on stage, because clearly he's a natural actor. And he discovers inside himself this thing he didn't know was there. But never mind, he feels it. And he abandons his earlier concept of Chuck and embraces this new emerging concept of Chuck. And then, because he's a person of responsibility, when he marries and has a child, he dedicates much of his time to protecting that, caring for that, making the money that is required for that, never letting go of this attachment that has grown in him to the theater. And the very minute that his responsibility recedes, his daughter no longer needs him to support her, he leaps from that job that everybody says he should stay in. Isn't he foolish? But he knows who Chuck is. And so again, he simply leaves the safe thing, leaves the old identity, and embraces himself. And as you can hear, this is so clearly the right choice for Chuck, because everything he says about it, as an actor, as a director, as a producer, as an advocate for Black theater, you can hear the passion, the commitment in his voice. So I play interviews like this, hoping that you will hear it and listen to yourself and wonder, is this what I sound like when I talk about what I do with my life? Am I leaping into the thing that screams that it is for me, or am I holding back because something else is safer, or other people won't understand, or no one else would do it, or, you know, all the reasons that we give ourselves? And if you find yourself in that bind, maybe you do want to think about going into therapy to explore how you became someone who is unable to be themselves. We're going to go out on myself reading a review by Pam Wiley of Knock Me a Kiss as more evidence that you should come on out and see it. It's only running for a little bit longer, but it is there and it is so wonderful, both as an entertainment and as a historical document. So I want to say, as always, that I hope that you got something from this show. Something that amused you, informed you, tickled you, something that'll bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too. As produced by the West Coast Black Theater Troupe, Knock Me a Kiss is an engaging and enlightening story inspired by the actual events surrounding the 1928 marriage of W.E.B. Du Bois's daughter, Yolande, to one of Harlem's great poets, County Cohen. Denoting the height of the Harlem Renaissance, the marriage was viewed as the ideal union of Negro talent and beauty. The marriage appears to be perfect amid the triumph of pomp and pageantry, but fails to be a union of a man and a woman. The play opens as jazz band leader Jimmy Lunsford pursues a willing yet apprehensive Yolande, who insists that she and Jimmy may be married, but only in a manner consistent with her status. At the same time, Du Bois, the larger-than-life Black activist, scholar, and co-founder of NAACP, manipulates County to take a wife of great breeding, stature, and education. When County realizes that Yolande appears to possess all of the attributes outlined by the elder Du Bois, he sets out to win her affection. It looks like a happy ending, but is it? Starring in the show are Imani Cadet as W.E.B. Du Bois, Lanissa Fredericks as Lenora, Ethan Henry as County Cohen, Makeba Henry as Nina Du Bois, Joel Patrick King as Jimmy Lunsford, and Emerald Rose Sullivan as Yolande Du Bois. Joel Patrick King enters, bursting with energy and swagger, as Lunsford. His dreams know no end, and he must have Yolande to share them.
King is a force to be reckoned with on stage. As Yolande Sullivan shines as the daughter, her need for Jimmy is palpable, but her wish to honor her conservative father tears at her natural instincts, all of which are clearly portrayed. Ethan Henry's County is a gentleman to the end, but is he able to put his personal happiness before doing the right thing for the cause? As the refreshingly carnal Lenora, Yolande's worldlier friend, Lanissa Frederick, infuses the proceedings with wicked fun as she dispenses toe-curling, down-and-dirty advice about how to please and be pleased by a man. It's hard to play a legend whose conversations are filled with theatrical speeches. E. Manny Cadet brings warmth to his demands and positiveness, which makes his role believable. As Nina Du Bois, Yolande's mother, Makeba Henry seems little involved with her daughter's confusion and distant from her husband. Charles Smith's play is smartly directed by Chuck Smith, who is no relation, on a luxurious set designed by Steve Petmagrian with lights by Michael Paschini that keep us focused in the right mood. Christy Owens' costumes help confirm the character's place in life. Knock Me a Kiss runs from January 7th through February 8th.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang.